Welcome everyone to the series Into the Heartland. This is a continuation of our series where we will explore the cultural perspectives of migrant women on the topic of domestic and family violence. Before we start, my guest Ranu and I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land where we work, play and live, the Gubbi Gubbi people. We acknowledge their spiritual and cultural belonging and recognize their continuing connection to land, waters, and culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Ranu was part of the social media campaign and photographic exhibition that Nambour Community Centre designed to feature migrant women. Ranu is married with four children. She is of Papua New Guinean Australian descent, born in Papua New Guinea, but living in Australia, Queensland. Ranu has 30 years as an early childhood professional working directly with children and their families. Ranu juggles many roles. Let's have a chat with Ranu. Welcome, Ranu.
Thank you for having me today. And I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that I live, work and play on and that we're meeting on today, the lands of the Gubbi Gubbi or Kubbi Kubbi peoples. I want to acknowledge their ancestors who are past and how they work to hold onto their culture to be able to pass on through the generations to the leaders and elders who are in our community today, who also continue to pass that knowledge on to the future old people, the young ones that I sometimes come into contact with through my life. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Ranu. This is an interesting space for me. I have not been to Papua New Guinea before. I would really be interested to know more about Papua New Guinea and how you grew up as a young child.
Yeah, so I was born in Papua New Guinea in the 70s, 1971. And we lived in Papua New Guinea for another year or two. Mm-hmm. The marriage of my mother and father was the first marriage of an Australian man to a Gubba Gubba woman. And my village is called Gubba Gubba. Mm-hmm. Gubba Gubba means drum drum. And we can trace our connection back to that village to 29, 30 generations, possibly more now. It was founded by three young men, Arileke, Loleke, and another person who I can't remember now. So, you know, our village Gubba Gubba is an hour's drive from Port Moresby. We are ocean people, mm-hmm. So our village is built over the ocean, although today houses are also built on the land. Papua New Guinea is a very diverse country. We have over 800 languages and 2,000 dialects, so it is incredibly diverse. In fact, the village that is just 15-20 minute drive inland from my village has different cultural practices and different language to my village. So it's very diverse, yeah.
So with all the different languages that you just highlighted, is there one particular language that connects?
I think today Tok Pisin is the language.
Tok Pisin?
Yeah. And but my language is Motu, and this is the language of the villages that... So there are 12 Motu-speaking villages, and in the middle of these 12 Motu-speaking villages is Port Moresby, which is the capital of Papua New Guinea. So Hanwa Bada is the big village. Hanwa is village, big Bada. This is the main village in Port Moresby, and they share the same language group. So my village is the last Motu-speaking village going southeast, and there's... I can't remember the names of all of the villages, but yeah. So our language is Motu. So Motu was spoken in Port Moresby because that's the language of that land. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do believe that nowadays Tok Pisin is the language that everyone, you know, it's spoken in those main towns. Mm. Yeah. And English. People speak English. Children learn, go to school and are taught in English, yeah. Mm.
So I would be interested to know your journey from Papua New Guinea to Australia.
Yeah, so my father's a teacher, he's an educator, and they always, moving back to Australia was always part of the plan. When he met my mother, he was an Australian volunteer abroad. And so they moved back to Adelaide, where my dad was the principal of the Aboriginal College in Adelaide. And he was there for a couple of years, 10 odd years, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I was about two when we moved back to Australia.
So you were two when you arrived in Australia?
Yeah. Back and forward, you know, between then, visiting, because my dad would bring me to visit his parents, of course. But we migrated back to Australia, moved back to Australia to live when I was two, but we've always been very strongly connected to our village. So we have a home in the village. Every second Christmas was in the village. The other Christmas was here in Brisbane, where we would come to visit my dad's family. He was born in Miles, so.
So there's still a very strong cultural connection.
Very strong cultural connection, yeah. Mm. And as educators, my dad understood the importance of intentional teaching and making sure that his children, who were born in the 70s, well, you know, I was born in the 70s at a time when the marriage of a black woman to a white man was a bit controversial. Mm. And, you know, in 1969 in America, it was still illegal for that type of a union. So he knew that he needed to grow his children up to be strong in culture, knowing who they were and where they were from, because the strength of that would provide the resilience for us when faced with the discrimination and racism that we grew up with here in Australia. So it was very strategic. It was very intentional.
So he instilled the values, the strength, the resilience within the family, the children.
By knowing our culture. Because in Australia, we were always picked on, or, you know, not always, but, you know, we were identified as children of colour. When I go home to Papua New Guinea, I am often identified as a white woman. So we live in this, you know, space of being neither black nor white.
And how does it sit with you?
Well, it's all I've known. I'm the oldest of the four children. And, yeah, it has at times been challenging to be not enough of one or the other. But that's, I can't change that. I can't change that. All I can do is be strong enough to weather that.
So connecting back to the intention of this podcast with migrant women on the topic of domestic and family violence, from my understanding of what you've shared, there are really, really strong, positive values that your parents have instilled in you and your family.
Yeah.
It would really be interesting to explore the cultural perspectives of domestic and family violence in your culture. It's not that, you know, this conversation is more about the cultural perspectives, not so much about women who have lived experience or women who are in a situation where they are navigating it in their current lives. So this perspective that I'm exploring with you is, what are your cultural perspectives or understanding of domestic and family violence in that context?
Look, I became aware of domestic violence at a young age, going back to Papua New Guinea and witnessing it in my own family. I was also aware that it wasn't right. My mum's real feisty, and if she could hear it or see it, she would. I know how she is. She would have been in there, you know, straight away separating people. I didn't understand what it was. I didn't know that it was called domestic violence. I saw it as a drunk uncle, you know, beating up on his wife. I found it shocking, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why it was happening.
But your mother was a strong advocate, and when there were any sort of domestic violence happening around the family, your mother would intervene.
Yeah, she would speak.
She would speak.
She didn't know how to not speak. She's still like that today. She speaks her mind. Whether that would have been standing on the veranda and telling someone to stop it, certainly getting in amongst it if she needed to. She was also a mother with, you know, four children herself, and being conscious of that. She certainly, whether she meant to or not, both her and my father instilled in us this, I guess, unconscious knowledge that that's not okay.
That's not okay.
Yeah.
So from that sharing that you just spoke on, that your mother would step in and she would have a very strong voice, is that the norm in Papua New Guinea?
Of the women stepping in? I think women and are more and more speaking up about domestic violence in Papua New Guinea. We have some very high statistics around that, and I, you know, some of our statistics, certainly on the Human Rights Watch website in, from 2021, says that a woman is beaten every 30 seconds, and more than 1.5 million people experience gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea every year. In 2020, 15,444 cases of domestic violence was reported, but only 250 people were prosecuted. So, and fewer than 100 people convicted. You know, it is there. Papua New Guinean women experience violence from allegations of sorcery. In different regions, it's, I guess, you know, like with Australia, it would be different. It would be different in different regions, and certainly in some of those highland provinces, women are experiencing this other kind of violence where they're being burnt for being, you know, accused of witchcraft, and sometimes that's it's on our news, and it's an issue. It's definitely an issue in my country.
And it's still ongoing.
It's still ongoing. So in 2021, on the 7th of May, Mary Kopari was accused of sorcery following the death of a young boy in her village. And she was tied up and burned alive in her district. And this attack was recorded, video recorded, you know, on people's phones. The time that I read this was in September 2021, of course, although the police knew the identity of attackers, no arrests had been made. So
how do you feel about that?
It makes me angry, very angry. One of the Miss PNG beauty pageant women, Ruby, I believe her name is from my village, and she was murdered by her partner through domestic violence. So this is a woman of my village. She's not the only one. It makes me angry, and I feel great shame that our men have forgotten about the strength of our women and how strong we are.
Now that you're living in Australia, what would you do if you or somebody around you were experiencing domestic and family violence?
Look, I think that I feel quite fearful for women. I have daughters. I have three daughters. And I have worked hard to raise my daughters to know what is okay and what is not acceptable behaviour, and to run. No matter what, get out. But when you are in that situation, I think it's a space that needs to be treaded gently. And with compassion and kindness for the woman, because, you know, our statistics show that it's in that time when she's leaving that she is at most risk of harm. And so that needs to be considered, and women need to be supported to leave a situation.
So you have had conversations with your daughters, and you
definitely
have, and you have actually addressed how best to empower them.
Absolutely. You know, a very good friend of mine, Mary Ann Taliapau, is the person who created the Billion Star Movement against violence. And I've taken my daughters to star weaving workshops where they have sat with women and listened to us talking about, you know, I don't hide these conversations from my daughters. I think they need to hear them and they need to hear our women saying this is not okay. And, you know, when the Billion Star Movement was only a Million Star Movement, Marianne was gathering stars from all over the world to contribute to her installation that was at the Commonwealth Games. And I brought my daughters in to help count stars. And we were opening boxes and reading letters from people from all over the world sending in and talking about their experiences, whatever that was, but their support of this movement against, you know, physical or not just, it's not just physical, but harming each other.
That's a great way to actually bring awareness into the community. Definitely. What are some of the ways that you have considered connecting and bringing awareness into the community?
I guess, you know, as an early childhood person, I have talked about the importance of children being safe and the rights of a child to feel safe. And so it comes through in my work in how I talk with the educators that I'm working with and how we talk to children about being kind to each other and being gentle with each other and kindness, being kind, I guess, is the biggest message. In my community, it's about, like, as I've gotten older, I seek out opportunities, I guess, to sit with women. And usually this is for my own benefit because I'm seeking out people in my community to sit with and talk with because it's healing. Culture is healing. So I love sitting with women in circle and talking, and when I run BILM workshops, making workshops, or cultural awareness workshops, I am talking about as well the safety of our women and raising awareness that violence is not okay. Like, that may not be what the workshop is about, but it is a conversation that comes out. You know, in my village, I was interviewing some, I was doing a project for my master's and just recording the stories of different people in my village. And one of the men I interviewed said, you know, the woman is the work beast of the family.
The work beast of the family.
The work beast of the family, which sounds horrendous. I don't know what the, what our language term may be for it, but what he was saying to me is that she provides everything for her family.
Sounds powerful, doesn't it?
She is. Our women are powerful. And, you know, I remember my grandmother walking to the river and filling up a 44-gallon drum and putting that on her head and carrying it back with water and carrying that back to the house so there was water at the house.
There's a lot of respect as you speak about your cultural perspective, your cultural values. I really am mindful that the vision in my mind goes back to your mother when you were talking about how domestic violence could be happening around you and your mother would step in and intervene. I see you as your mother with regards to empowering your daughters and bringing a sense of awareness.
Yeah.
And I also think it's really important to highlight to the listeners that you do juggle a lot of roles in one of them. The only reason is I'm really, really interested in all the different roles that you do. And one of it is you're a member of the Brisbane-based Pacific Women's Weaving Circle. And I see that this is connected to how you would like to actually be involved in community and use that space to have conversations.
So, you know, I grew up watching my mum, a Papua New Guinean woman, living in Australia, looking for her people. So I remember when we moved from Darwin, we moved from Adelaide up to Darwin where we lived for 26 years. And when we first got there, one of the first things my mum needed to do was find her people. And she would drag us to the mall and we would sit in the mall waiting for a Papua New Guinean to walk past so that she could find where her people were. And we were sitting there and this woman walked past. She was actually Fijian, but she knew a Papua New Guinean, and she said to Mum, "Oh, I'm not Papua New Guinean, but I know someone who's Papua New Guinean. I'll take you to her." And this person was my mum's second cousin.
And your mother's second cousin?
Yeah. So she, you know, they found each other. Oh. And she went to school with my mum's big sister, and Auntie Rokaya was, you know, really connected to my family for many years. She supported us. She loved us. She was my mum's best friend. But I would watch my mum sitting with women, always sitting with Papua New Guinean women, talking to them, bringing their children to the house, perhaps bringing them to the house.
Ranu, this is really interesting. This is all before the internet, before social media.
Yeah.
Your mother was proactive.
Oh, yeah.
Engaging.
Yeah, yeah.
Seeking.
Mm.
Mm. Not being complacent.
No. And I used to, I was embarrassed by that.
Were you?
As a child, I was like, oh, shame. Just run up to someone we don't know. Or, you know, if somebody, and there were other incidences where, and this is an example of my mum's feistiness, my brother, one of my siblings, we were in Adelaide, accidentally spilt their milkshake on this white man who called, you know, a child. I'm thinking whichever sibling it was would have been under the age of six at the time, five or six, and called this sibling of mine a racial, you know, threw a racial slur at them. And my mum, she's a short woman, puffed up and challenged this man, "How dare you speak to my child like that?" You know, an example of her feistiness. Or she would, you know, we were in the shopping centre, this white man just pushed my sibling out of the way and walked past. "Get out of the way, you little..." And my mum, I remember my mum chasing after him up and down the aisles to, you know, "Don't you do that to my child." So that, and, you know, example of how she speaks up and protects, in this case it was her children. But she would do that for our women too, and bring them to our homes for a cup of tea. If they needed an escape, they were brought to our house.
Is there a group of women on the Sunshine Coast that you connect with that have those values of feistiness and assertiveness and not allowing?
Yeah. So I draw my women from wherever they are. Sometimes we meet on the Sunshine Coast. There are Papua New Guinean elders here that I do like to remain connected with and talk with, and just to be able to sit with them when they sit with my mum and listen to language. I have a group of what I call Pacifica sisters who I draw in to be with me as well, and we connect as often as we can, and that's where that Pacific Weaving, Brisbane-based Pacific Weaving Circle, that's how I met some of them. Mm. I mean, one is my own sister.
Oh, really?
And, you know, two other women, another lady, Nata, who comes from the next village on from me, who is also a Papua New Guinea Australian girl, and then my weaving friend, Marianne. We often talk about the strength of our women and our children as well, and raising our children. I have daughters, my sister has sons. We talk about how we want our children to be kind and strong in their convictions and stand up for what's right.
Could I revisit with what you just said with regards to the elders, the sisters, the community that has banded together on the Sunshine Coast? If anyone in that space or anybody outside of the community who are Papua, how would it be best to support them?
Yeah, I think that I think our cultural groups need to be able to be supported to meet together. Unfortunately, the PNG Sunshine Coast Group hasn't met since COVID in its capacity. Certainly the people that were coming to that group would have been probably in that at risk. So we haven't been meeting. Although I have held some events, not formal events, like small events, just to be able to sit with...
To reconnect.
Some of the elders, yeah. But, you know, from my memories of growing up in Darwin, our cultural communities were financially supported to be able to meet together somehow. And that was so important for providing safe spaces for our groups to meet, where if there were issues of domestic violence or child abuse, whatever that was, we were already within a supportive network that we could draw on kinship care perhaps, or the support of elders to talk about how we should be raising our children.
So it starts from family. It starts from children, from the ground roots, values.
From the community, though. I haven't lived in the Sunshine Coast long, so I'm not sure. Like, we were financially supported for that. There were small grants that we had people supporting us to write grants to be able to have Papua New Guinea school, for example, on a Saturday. I went to Papua New Guinea school on a Saturday growing up until I was in grade 10 or 11. That provided a safe space where our children were coming together. We were together with other children that looked like us.
Could that be a vision, a possibility for that to be recreated on the Sunshine Coast?
Mm. Yeah, it would be great if it was. It needs people in the community to be able to want to drive that. Sometimes our communities can be a bit political and there can be fighting. So that can, you know, that's just the way it is. That's just the stuff that happens. But certainly, supporting community groups to, some people in our community groups aren't skilled at writing for grants.
Mm.
So they, and where do you find them? Like, in the first place, how do you know which grants you can apply for? How do you know how to write, how this will benefit you and your children?
So from what you're saying, if we could actually create a community where the Papua New Guineans could gather to connect, to recreate what you spoke of in your home country, in your village, do you think it would take a bit of time?
Yeah, I think that, those things don't just happen overnight. There needs to be connection in the community and then there needs to be people who can drive that. But I benefited from that as a child. I can see the value and benefit in it. My experience in the Sunshine Coast has been difficult to be someone who is of a diverse culture. And so, you know, personally, I found myself running away from the Sunshine Coast. I was anxious about that. So, yeah.
Are you comfortable to talk about the challenges that you have?
I guess it's the racism that is here that I didn't think was here anymore. Like, I hadn't experienced some of the racism that I've experienced here in the Sunshine Coast for many years.
So it sounds like there are certain limitations, there are barriers on the Sunshine Coast that the community needs to be aware to perhaps be more supportive.
And, you know, providing spaces where cultural groups can bring their culture and share in a really gentle way. They just had Festuri here, or is it about to come? They've just had it, Festuri down here. Like, there are opportunities. When we grew up in Darwin, whenever there was a community event, the multicultural community was invited to come and dance and cook your food and be present in those events. I'm not so sure that I've seen that here in the Sunshine Coast, but I also haven't been looking for it.
I am aware that Nambour Community Centre is creating opportunities for communities together to connect, to belong.
Yeah.
And this could be the start of a conversation that we can continue to have. But I would like to acknowledge, Ranu, this conversation that we've had has actually addressed a lot of cultural values, a lot of cultural memories that you have brought and you carried with you to Australia. You're having that conversation with your children, your daughters. You're active in the community. There's many things that you have shared during this space that has given me a lot of joy. You've actually given me knowledge that I was not aware of. And this will be really beneficial to the listeners who will be empowered by your feisty mother, by your father, who has ensured that the values has been ingrained into you and your siblings and how you are now empowering the community with the work that you're doing. I thank you very much, Ranu, for being in this space, for being open, for being authentic, and also being vulnerable. Thank you, Ranu.
Nice.